I'm joined now by Carol Ann Bassett, the author of Galapagos at the Crossroads, Pirates, Biologists, Tourists, and Creationists, Battle for Darwin's Cradle of Evolution. Bassett is a freelance writer and radio producer who has contributed to the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, National Public Radio, The Nation, and many other national publications. Bassett is the author of three books, and she currently teaches environmental writing, literary nonfiction, and multimedia at the University of Oregon. Carol Ann Bassett, welcome to LA Theater Works, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Talk to us about how you first came to the Galapagos and the purpose of your journey there.
I first visited the Galapagos in 1990 as a young journalist on assignment for a national magazine. I was writing about the national parks of Ecuador, and Galapagos is the major national park of Ecuador in South America, and it is also a province. So that's why I traveled there. And when I first visited the Galapagos, it seemed to me like some kind of primordial dreamscape. There were endemic species that exist nowhere else on the earth, like giant land tortoises the size of wine barrels and marine iguanas that once lived on land but have adapted to swimming in the sea and diving to feed on algae. In fact, they can hold their breath up to 1 hour underwater. There are vampire finches that feed off the blood of masked boobies. There are so many wonderful examples that are also fairly bizarre that I often tell people visiting the Galapagos is like stepping into Alice in Wonderland. For example, gigantism is one of the elements of adaptation on these very remote islands.
Explain to us the process of gigantism, how it occurs.
In the case of the giant land tortoise feeding on cactus, and the cactus growing taller so it can adapt and survive and not be nibbled to death, as the opuntia grows taller, on some islands, the carapace of the giant land tortoise has adapted and formed into a kind of saddle shape so that they can poke their heads up higher to get those cactus pads that are so important for their diet.
Important but elusive.
Yes, it is a very bizarre and fascinating place. There are things taking place like sexual crossover in species.
Elaborate on that.
I will. Sea turtles and land tortoises, for example, if the temperature in the nest chamber is too warm, then it can result in all of the hatchlings becoming female. So if you think about climate change and the warming of nests, there will be all females. If the temperature, on the other hand, is cool, then a nest could yield all males.
And that also is referred to in Michael's play.
Yes, it's amazing how many things he got absolutely head on.
When did conservation first become an issue in the Galapagos?
Conservation actually goes back many decades, more than 50 years. In 1964, the Charles Darwin Research Station, our setting, opened to support Galapagos National Park in scientific research. And so conservation was becoming an issue at that point in 1964. The national park was established much earlier, but it did not have the kind of expertise needed to monitor species and make sure that they weren't declining or becoming extinct.
So in Michael Hollinger's play, which is based on a series of real-life events that took place in the Galapagos in the mid-90s, we see this growing opposition to the philosophy of conservation. Is that when it really started to heat up, that controversy about conservation, or did that occur earlier when the conservation unit was first established in the 60s?
Well, at first, I don't think that the locals were that concerned because very few people lived on the islands. And so most of them were probably not aware of the activities of this research station.
Michael's play takes place in the 90s. Is that when things began to get controversial, when the conservation movement ran up against the island population and the government's need to promote tourism?
I would agree that things started to heat up around 1990. In fact, when I visited in 1990, I was very concerned about the survival of the islands and the rich biodiversity there because there were so many tourists. I mean, in some places it seemed more like Coney Island than isolated rocks out in the Pacific.
Mm.
And I learned during the research for my book that the head of the Charles Darwin Research Station in 1990 had written in a report that he agreed that tourism was getting out of hand and that the islands were going to become at risk very soon.
Give us an example of something in the play that struck you for its veracity and astuteness with regard to what the situation was, how he was able as a dramatist to really explain to us some of the things that were going on.
Sure. Dr. Baines, she may come across like a caricature in the play, but her attitudes ring true. She's a clueless outsider and a control freak who lacks cultural sensitivity. That is something that has happened with directors of the research station in the past. There have been many of them. Another example is that there's tension with Carlos, the Galapagueño, who she learns had applied for her job, and the fact that there's a social resentment on his part towards outsiders who are always chosen as the directors of the station. The Galapagos congressman, the diputado,
yes,
Mendoza,
mm-hmm,
ranting over the radio and inciting fishermen to riot, absolutely true. The man Gonzalo from the station, who is Dr. Baines's aide, telling her to pay attention to the money changing hands down at the docks and saying, "There are no rules here," right on. The political power of the fishermen in one scene playing guitars and singing, "We own everything, don't mess with us," absolutely true. All of the segments on the invasive species and the Judas goats and species versus species, absolutely. And then the pepinero uprisings, the sea cucumber fishermen, reacting to quotas being put on their catches with clubs and machetes and Molotov cocktails and burning down buildings in at least 5 years, five instances, absolutely true.
So where are we today with all of these issues?
Today there are some improvements in working on sustainable tourism and introducing environmental education into the schools. There are numerous NGOs or non-governmental organizations that work in conjunction with the research station or Galapagos National Park as advisors and technicians in the field. For example, they are now monitoring sharks to see where they migrate. Spiny lobster, which the fishermen fished out, is now being monitored by GPS units from outer space. There is wind power in place on at least one island, which is very effective. It's windy there. Solar energy is coming into play. So there are solutions that people are working on, but it's going to take some time. In fact, it's going to take maybe one or two generations, I think, because now children are educating their parents about things the parents never learned.
When and how did the Galapagos first come to the attention of foreign businessmen as a source for sea cucumbers?
Well, I believe that was in about 1995. And that's when subsistence fishermen discovered that sea cucumbers fetched a lot of money on the Asian market because when dried up and desiccated, the species is considered an aphrodisiac in some Asian countries.
Which is referred to, of course, in the play, yeah.
Studies show that this is absolutely false. It has no effect on erectile dysfunction whatsoever. But they were making about as much money as you could in the cocaine business. These were subsistence fishermen who were all of a sudden on this bonanza, lighting, you know, bills on fire, lighting cigarettes with money, lining their boats up outside of the chongos or brothels and throwing wads of money on the floor and watching the chicas stoop down to snatch up the bills. It was just absolutely crazy. And when quotas were placed on what they could catch or how much they could catch, the first uprising out of the five that I'm aware of occurred in 1995.
So sea cucumbers are just one of many cash crops which have been harvested illegally on the Galapagos.
Right, and they may look like squishy, ugly things, but they're actually very important to the entire ecosystem because they're bottom feeders, and they produce and stir up nutrients for other species. But there are other species that are definitely sought as cash markets, among them sea lion penises.
And what are they used for?
They're considered aphrodisiacs in Asia. Another species of grave concern is the shark. Sharks are apex species. They're top predators, and they are being illegally caught and killed and their fins cut off for shark fin soup in Asia. And then the poor creature is tossed back into the ocean to bleed to death and drown. And this is still happening. Just recently, there was a bust of a ship that had perhaps a ton of shark fins that were going to another middleman ship to head off to Asia. And those poachers were busted by Sea Shepherd Galapagos.
And what is Sea Shepherd Galapagos?
Well, we think of Sea Shepherd, we think of the whale warriors, radical environmentalists, but not in this case, in the Galapagos. In fact, Sea Shepherd has a legal contract with not only Galapagos National Park, but Galapagos Environmental Police. They're a non-governmental organization that is conservation-based and that is helping catch poachers and prosecute them.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the government of Ecuador. In the play, certainly the congressman is portrayed as someone who is aiding and abetting a lot of this illegal poaching. What is the position now of the Ecuadorian government, official and non-official, and how effective are they in upholding the conservation laws?
Well, it depends on if we are speaking about the government on the mainland of Ecuador or the provincial government in the Galapagos. There are problems that originate on the mainland by ministers who may have never visited the Galapagos, yet they're writing laws for the Galapagos that make no sense. There is also a great deal of political power among the fishermen because some astute fishermen got into politics back during the uprising era and rallied fishermen to join their cause so that they could wield greater power.
So this was in the 90s?
This was still going on when I lived there in 2007 and 2008. Mm-hmm. So this is very complex, the question that you asked. Even the people who live in the Galapagos and work in the government offices in the Galapagos don't understand the process. It's not clear if there are regulations. They're often ignored, or they could be tweaked, or they could be changed overnight without anyone being informed. For example, when I was on the island of Isabela on the far west side of the archipelago. Back in 2006, I ran a program where I brought my university students there to write about environmental issues. We were very excited because in the morning we were going to wake up and go sea kayaking and observe Galapagos penguins and flamingos cohabitating in the same ecosystem. I mean, imagine that on the equator. We were told when we got to the dock that sea kayaking had just been dissed by the national park because it was considered a sport and not a recreation, and sports like scuba diving need to have licenses. And so it was a big disappointment and an eye-opener for me and others, because things can change overnight at a whim without any rationale behind it.
In your book, Galapagos at the Crossroads, you interviewed a number of fishermen who have become staunch allies of conservationism. How do you explain their change of heart?
There is a new opportunity for fishermen, and it has been developing over the last decade or so, and that is special training for fishermen to become dive masters, scuba diving masters, and to go through all of the courses and the physics and the math. And it's difficult for someone who doesn't have that much education, but many of them have done quite well and are absolutely the finest dive masters in the Galapagos. One example of a pretty notorious shark finner turned dive master who runs his own diving shop. He had come home one day after fishing, and his young daughter, who was perhaps 5 years old, had seen something on TV, I believe, about the finning of sharks. And when her dad walked into the house, she asks him, "Daddy, you don't do this, do you?" And he thought about it that night, and he was so ashamed when he realized that he actually was doing this. He was getting wealthy doing this. But his young daughter was questioning his morals at age 5. Mm. Another dive master told me that he used to do shark finning and all of the other practices that bring in money that I described earlier. But when he learned to dive, the world underwater was so magical to him that he could see a connection between species, a network of life that needed to survive without other species being depleted. So he experienced an extreme change of heart and was really regretful about how he had lived and earned his money in the past.
Is conservationism still a minority view among the fishermen there?
I think it is. But I think that that has changed in the last few years, because once the fishermen outfished their own livelihoods, the special law for the Galapagos that was passed in 1998 allowed them more autonomy, more boat permits, and a lot of them began entering the tourism industry and running tourists back and forth to nearby islands without proper training, without knowledge of other languages. And so they entered tourism after fishing their whole lives, but knowing absolutely nothing about natural history or sustainable tourism. And part of that lies in the fact that they were not educated very well themselves. The educational system in Ecuador and the Galapagos pretty much follows an old Marxist system of know the question, know the answer. And so critical thinking is not really part of the curriculum. Also, many of the people who live in Galapagos, the majority, in fact, and I believe about 30,000 people now live on the Galapagos Islands, they are relative newcomers. And so there isn't a deep connection to the land as there would be with an indigenous culture living in the Andes. They have come to make money off of tourism. It's very much like the old American West, this gold rush in sea cucumbers or becoming a tour operator and getting, you know, quick fix and then what? And so they don't really understand a lot about the nature that's all around them, which is very troublesome.
So given all of this, I mean, you're describing some inspiring incidents of change and better understanding on the part of the indigenous population of why conservation is important, but it sounds as though there's a long way to go. What are the key steps that need to be taken to keep the Galapagos on the path to better conservation?
I can give you a few scenarios of what will happen to the Galapagos based on experts.
Okay.
In 2006, there was a symposium held where world experts on the Galapagos got together and tried to figure out three scenarios of what the Galapagos might look like in the future. The first scenario was that the Galapagos would be highly preserved and restored to a level of near pristine quality. The second scenario was that the Galapagos might become like a techno zoo, with bungalows and wildlife managed and controlled like some fantasy island. And the third scenario was that the Galapagos might become another Hawaii, where, you know, jet skis are allowed and golf courses are built on islands like Isabella, and things begin to deteriorate because there's no limit on the tourists either. The experts put their heads together and chose scenario number two. In other words, the Galapagos will not be highly preserved and restored based on the reality today, but they will likely become managed as a techno zoo where international visitors can feel like they're having a real exotic kind of experience when, in fact, it's the opposite.
Do you agree with that scenario?
It's hard to say, but I think tourism brings in enough money that that is certainly possible. I also believe that the islands and their unusual wildlife will survive. The islands are very young. They're one of the youngest volcanic archipelagos in the world, and they're still being born because there is a hot spot under the farthest island to the west, Fernandina, and it keeps erupting and creating new landmass. And I think perhaps Homo sapiens is on the way out, but the creatures that live on these islands will continue to adapt and evolve and morph into things that are unimaginable. And wouldn't it be fun to be there to see that?
And what a triumph of nature over
human nature.
Over human nature. Well, on that hopeful note, thank you so much, Carol Ann. This was fascinating.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have been speaking with Carol Ann Bassett, the author of Galapagos at the Crossroads.